This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. While much of the country stifled a collective yawn at the 2018 NBA Finals matchup, same as the 2017 NBA Finals matchup, same as the 2016 and 2015 NBA Finals matchups, actor Jesse Eisenberg has been looking back at another NBA Finals matchup and a story that might have been. Here's Jesse.
The 1992-93 NBA season was a tour de force for the Phoenix Suns. They won a franchise record 62 games, they clinched first place in the competitive Western Conference, and they boasted the league's MVP, the round mound of rebound, Sir Charles Barkley.
Barkley, 20-footer, yes, Charles Barkley!
The world was shocked, then, when the Chicago Bulls upended this dream team in the final seconds of Game 6 of the 1993 NBA Finals. Suns fans around the world watched the final 14 seconds of this game like it was the Zapruder film, parsing each moment, wondering what went wrong.
The Suns by two. It has come down to this possession.
The Chicago Bulls, down by two, ran a play called the Blind Pig, where every player touched the ball. And with 4 seconds left, it wound up in the hands of John Paxson, a largely unheralded marksman whose life was about to change.
Here's Paxson for three!
The Suns looked amateurish by comparison, flummoxed as the ball changed hands. Charles Barkley frantically chased B.J. Armstrong. Suns point guard and future mayor of Sacramento, Kevin Johnson, collapsed on the floor. And my favorite player, Thunder Dan Majerle, a two-time all-defensive player, raised his hands helplessly under the basket 20 feet from the man with the ball, as if to signal a surrender. So what happened? Where did John Paxson's surge of confidence come from? And how did Dan Majerle, a defensive master, so helplessly lose focus? It was me. I am responsible. Yes, I am the reason the Phoenix Suns lost the NBA Finals that year. It was 1993. I was in fourth grade, living in the middle of New Jersey. And my life was pretty boring. I had the same number of friends as I had enemies, one. And both my friend and my enemy were not such good versions of either one. That is, my friend, Teddy, was not such a good friend, and my enemy, Steven, was not such a vicious rival. Teddy was a kind of friend by default. I didn't have much interest in other kids, and Teddy was kind of a doormat, so we hung out almost reluctantly, both just trying to get through the day.
No one wants to sit with me.
No one wants to sit with me either.
Should we sit together?
I don't care. And Steven, my enemy, was only my enemy in the way Hitler was the enemy of Norway. He was a brute, and I was just a tiny country in his way. He would taunt me and Teddy by throwing mulch at our heads.
Look at you losers, whose names I'm not gonna learn just sitting at the table together. If you were a real threat, I'd probably beat you up. But since you're insignificant, I'm just gonna throw mulch at your head.
Ow!
Now I understand how Hitler must have felt about Norway.
I was distraught. I mean, I had never been bullied before, and though Teddy didn't seem to mind the abuse, I knew that I needed to take action to get back at Steven. So I decided to write a letter to my favorite basketball player, Thunder Dan Majerle, asking him for help. And though I was only 9 years old, this fan letter would change the course of history. Dear Mr. Majerle, I am a big fan of you. You're my favorite player. And I know that one day we will both be playing as teammates on the Phoenix Suns. I know how to draw the logo, and I'm a great dribbler. But I am really in trouble right now, and you're the only one who could help me. There's a kid named Steven at school, and every day he throws mulch at my head, and also at my friend Teddy's head. It doesn't usually hurt, but sometimes it does. I thought that if you could come to the school, just at the end of the day, when I'm waiting for the bus, you don't have to come for the whole day, and pretend like we're best friends, and then when Steven throws mulch, you can be like, hey, don't throw mulch at my best friend Jesse and his friend Teddy. And then Steven will be so scared, especially because you're 6'6" and 222 pounds and score 13.9 points per game, that he will stop throwing mulch at my head, and then maybe he'll also think I was cool for having a friend like you, Dan Majerle, who is also my favorite basketball player. And then Steven and I will become friends, and I can finally stop hanging out with Teddy after school. From your number one fan, Jesse Eisenberg from New Jersey. Now, of course, on the surface, the letter seems totally innocuous. But in retrospect, it's easy to see how its recipient would have reacted. In fact, I've imagined the scene in the locker room when Dan Marley gets my letter. It's the day of the fateful Game 6 of the NBA Finals. And Sir Charles Barkley is suiting up when he hears Dan Marley in a rage.
Dan Marley, what's wrong? Are you okay?
No, Charles Barkley, I'm not okay. I'm furious.
Why? What happened?
This kid, Jesse Eisenberg from New Jersey, asked me to come visit him.
Well, no, that's just crazy. Doesn't he know we're in the finals?
Apparently, he doesn't even care.
What? That's a knucklehead. Now I'm enraged, too.
And take a guess why he wants me to come visit him.
Did he get into a car accident?
Nope.
Is he in a wheelchair?
Nope.
Well, I can't think of any other possible reason he'd ask you to leave during the most important game of your life.
He wanted me to come visit him so I could defend him from some douchebag named Steven who's throwing mulch at his head.
What? Well, why doesn't he just ask this Steven to stop throwing mulch at his head?
Right?
What is wrong with this world? I'm furious.
And he didn't even ask me how I'm doing. Or offer to fly me out to New Jersey so that I can save his life.
Oh, I hate this knucklehead Jesse. I can't think straight. Now, how am I going to play great basketball today?
What if I need to play defense during an important play? I am paralyzed with rage because of Jesse from New Jersey.
As am I. Yes, this letter from Jesse all but assures us of a terrible Game 6 in the NBA Finals tonight.
It's impossible to see that working out any other way. And then, of course, I imagine the opposing team's locker room, where Chicago Bulls shooting guard John Paxson has just finished reading a different fan letter.
Oh, isn't this nice?
Isn't what nice?
Oh, hey, Michael Jordan.
Hey, John Paxson. What are you reading?
I was just reading this fan letter from a kid who broke both his legs in a car accident.
Oh, wow. What's it say?
It says, "Dear Mr. Paxson, I'm currently in a wheelchair, and I will probably not be able to walk for a very long time, but I just wanted to wish you good luck in the NBA Finals." From Jeremy, age 9.
That is a nice letter.
Yes. This is how all fan letters should be written.
Yes, I agree. And because of this child, I feel ready to play at my best.
This child and his sensible note will allow us to win Game 6 of the NBA Finals against the Phoenix Suns.
Ha ha, yes it will.
Yeah.
And of course, they did win Game 6 of the NBA Finals against the Phoenix Suns. John Paxson, bolstered by Jeremy's selflessness, would make his game-winning three-pointer with 4 seconds left.
Here's Paxson for three! Yes!
And the Phoenix Suns, with their innocence punctured by my solipsistic note, would collapse. And as of right now, because of me, they have the worst record in the entire league. The tragic fallout from my letter was not confined to the Suns. You see, Michael Jordan, buoyed by Jeremy's life-affirming fan letter and John Paxson's shot, would win his third straight NBA championship and decide to leave basketball. But worse than Jordan's departure from basketball was his really odd and questionable decision to play baseball. This move tarnished not just Jordan's athletic mystique, but also the sport of baseball, which is America's pastime. So therefore, by natural extension, Jordan's departure from basketball tarnished America, a country that in the immediate aftermath of the Cold War was at its unparalleled height. So is it possible that America, weakened by Michael Jordan's hubris, which stemmed directly from my crippling fan letter, led to our failed intervention in Somalia? Did the sour mood linger for 2 years, driving President Bill Clinton to act out sexually as a desperate bomb to counteract America's diminished prestige? Have we ever truly scrutinized the housing crisis of 2007 as an inevitable outgrowth of a wave of societal risk-taking brought about by Michael Jordan's own risk-taking, his overestimation of his abilities as a baseball player? Is it possible that all of these American tragedies stem directly from my fan letter? Yes, it is possible. And yes, it is likely. After the Suns lost, I moved on from basketball, developing an interest in obscure musical theater where the damage I could inflict would have fewer consequences. The last I saw of my former hero was about a decade ago. My sister and I were watching TV when Thunder Dan Marley showed up, shirtless, in a commercial for deodorant.
I love to sweat.
My sister accused me of being in love with him because I liked him and he wasn't wearing a shirt. I wanted to tell her that I wasn't in love with him, I just liked basketball. But I didn't say anything. I didn't fight back. Because, in a way, this is who I've become. My letter and the subsequent fallout has turned me into a passive eunuch, too scared to ever fight back. I will sulk through life, getting hit in the head by the proverbial mulch. My letter altered history exclusively for the worse, and so I've put down my pen. If history is written by the winners, I'd rather be a loser.
That's actor Jesse Eisenberg. His story was produced by Jonathan Mitchell, and it comes to us from the Slate podcast Upon Further Review. It was written by Eisenberg for Mike Pesca's new book, which is called Upon Further Review. Days after the podcast dropped, a sports radio station in Arizona asked Dan Marley who he blamed for that son's loss. His answer was unequivocal. Danny Ainge, the current GM of the Boston Celtics. That sets the stage for the summit of sorts between Jesse Eisenberg and Dan Marley on 98.7 FM, Arizona's sports station.
Jesse, I'm sorry, man. If I would have just answered your letter or, you know, sent myself in New Jersey, maybe you could have been the next great point guard for the Phoenix Suns. Instead, you had to get into this acting gig. So I apologize for that. I feel terrible.
I also have to apologize because after I heard your defense of the play in question, I looked at it again on YouTube and I realized it was Danny Ainge's fault. I should be going to Boston now with my torch, and I made a big mistake.
And there you have it, folks. If only every disagreement could be resolved so easily. Do me a favor. Consider leaving a review of Only a Game on your favorite podcast app. It helps other listeners to find our show. You're listening to Only a Game from NPR.
What does it take to start something from nothing? And what does it take to actually build it? I'm Guy Raz. Every week on How I Built This, I speak with founders behind some of the most inspiring companies in the world. Find it on NPR One or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Bill Littlefield. The 2018 World Cup begins next week in Russia. At the last World Cup in 2014, the U.S. climbed gamely out of a group of death that included Germany, Portugal, and Ghana, and then, led by an exceptional performance by goalkeeper Tim Howard, they nearly advanced to the quarterfinals, losing to Belgium in extra time. The stage seemed to be set for further triumphs in 2018, but no, U.S. fans will have to find another team to support. Theirs didn't make it to Russia. How did that happen? The U.S. men's soccer team began the campaign to qualify for the World Cup on November 11, 2016, in Columbus, Ohio. It did not go well.
Into the near post, puts along, it's in! Mexico retake the lead!
The 2-1 loss to Mexico, despite the home field advantage, was, of course, disappointing. 4 days later, things got worse. The U.S. lost to Costa Rica 4-0. A win earns a team 3 points in the standings. You get 1 point from a tie. Two losses net the loser nothing, and nothing comes from nothing except firing the coach, Jürgen Klinsmann. The U.S. Soccer Federation brought back Bruce Arena, who'd coached the team from 1998 until 2006, and he knew what he was in for.
I certainly thought it was an honor. I realized that it was going to be a very difficult job.
Yeah, he had to say that, right? But come on, the U.S. is a great, big, strong, rich country playing against nations like Honduras, Panama, and Trinidad and Tobago. And surely the return of Bruce Arena would give their confidence a boost, right?
It was a group that was a little down, but my impression of the group was that they were a really good group of guys. I think the leadership of Michael Bradley and Tim Howard, for example, was outstanding. And I felt those veteran players were going to be able to help us get through what we knew was going to be a very difficult year in 2017.
The challenge would be to recover from the hapless start and begin to win or at least tie some games against the five other teams from North America, Central America, and the Caribbean that had reached the stage of qualifying called the Hex. not necessarily because of any curse, although this time, well, anyway, six teams, the hexagonal, the hex. Only three of those six teams would be guaranteed spots in Russia. The fourth would have to win a playoff game against a team from another conference to qualify. On March 24th, playing for the first time under Arena, the U.S. team rallied. They beat Honduras 6-0, which is kind of like a baseball team winning 24-0. So, a silly question for the coach. What was the feeling after that game?
Well, obviously, an outstanding result and a great feeling.
Except that three of the starters in that game went down with injuries serious enough to create doubt about their future availability. They did not play in the game against Panama 4 days after the 6-0 win. The U.S. came home with a draw, so just one more point. Over the remainder of the spring and into the summer, Arena's team, a mix of MLS stalwarts and players employed by teams in Europe, could remain optimistic, if cautiously so. A 2-0 win over Trinidad and Tobago was followed by an encouraging draw with Mexico at Estadio Azteca in Mexico City, always a difficult place for visitors to capture a point. But on September 1st, Costa Rica's team arrived at Red Bull Arena in New Jersey, where the U.S. should have had an advantage.
When we stepped on the field, about half the stadium was supporting the U.S. and the other half Costa Rica. We don't know how those people get tickets, you know, fans of the opposing team, but they manage to get them all the time.
Costa Rica delighted those fans by winning the game 2-0. I wondered if that loss left Bruce Arena thinking he was doing something wrong.
Well, we lost the game against Costa Rica. That's what we did wrong. We also made a real big mistake as a federation in putting that game in New York. Every game in qualifying is a battle, and every advantage you have, you got to take advantage of that. And we did not a very smart job in picking that venue.
Whoever was at fault, obviously the U.S. made no progress by losing that one, and little progress 4 days later when they traveled to Honduras. They needed an 85th-minute goal from Bobby Wood to salvage a draw. By October, with two games left to play, the U.S. sat fourth in the hex, a precarious position. Still, two wins would mean six more points, and that would enable the U.S. to rise up the table and qualify, no matter the results of the other games in the hex. Planning for Russia could begin.
So here we go. Panama occupying the vital third and final automatic qualification place for the World Cup.
On October 6th in Orlando, the U.S. hosted Panama, and this time the home team prevailed 4-0. So, as it worked out, a tie in the final game in Trinidad would suffice. The resultant 1 point would put the U.S. over the top, and all seemed in readiness. Or did it?
Well, nothing ever feels right when you're playing in a game in CONCACAF. You have the heat and humidity. The day before the game, we went to the game field and it was flooded and we literally could not train on it. So we didn't know exactly what the field conditions were going to be like on game day. And when we got there, we found out, you know, the field drained properly. And so there were no excuses at our end. And, you know, they scored off an unusual goal where Omar Gonzalez miscleared the ball and it ends up in the back of the net for an own goal.
Down one was perhaps discouraging. As it turned out, down two would be deflating.
Long distance blast, and it's Alvin Jones! One for the legend books! Oh my! His first...
Arena's team got one back in the 47th minute. From then on, the U.S. became increasingly desperate.
Their goalkeeper was playing very well. And in the closing minutes, we had the chance by Benny Feilhaber, the header inside the six-yard box.
Headed down, slapped away. The ball was headed in.
And then the shot from Clint Dempsey off the goalpost.
Ball blasted low, tapped off the post. Fonsette got a finger to it, and that might be the difference.
All of those in the closing minutes of the game. So it was just a matter of inches.
It is over. Trinidad, with nothing to play for, has dethroned the United States, knocking them out of the World Cup 2018.
Bruce Arena told me there wasn't much he could say to the players. They knew what they'd done and what they had failed to do. They'd failed to make it to the World Cup. But Arena did have something to say to the U.S. Soccer Federation. He said, "I resign."
Well, there was no point in me remaining. I was hired to try to get this team into the World Cup. No one else was going to stand up and take any kind of responsibility, and I felt that it was in order that I do that.
Arena left behind some recommendations. Schedule home games that won't be convenient for the other team's fans. Work on building soccer in this country rather than making money by playing Mexico and Southern California. Encourage MLS to employ fewer foreign players and concentrate on developing homegrown talent. But Arena does not feel that failure to make the World Cup will fundamentally diminish soccer in the U.S.
It affects things commercially and politically. It doesn't impact where the sport is going because the sport continues to grow at the major league level. But there needs to be an improvement in technical leadership for our game. Everything has laid fairly idle since that day in October, and that is now about 6 months ago. So it indicates to me again that the leadership still doesn't get it.
Bruce Arena, gone as a coach but not forgotten, though maybe some of the people in that leadership to which he refers might wish it were otherwise. Bruce Arena's new book is What's Wrong with the U.S., or What's Wrong with Us, I guess, since there are no periods after the capital U and the capital S. Clever. So the U.S. is not in the World Cup. Who should you root for instead? That's where we're going to start this week on Three Stories You Should Know. I'm joined by Craig Calcaterra of NBC Sports and by Julie DeCaro. She's a sports writer and host at Chicago's 670 The Score. Welcome back to both of you.
Thanks for having me.
Hi, Bill.
Julie, please advise. Help these people who are looking for a team to root for in the World Cup.
Well, I am here to help. So if you are lucky enough to be English or Mexican or Japanese or Iranian, you have it easy. You just get to root for your home country. The next step is to root for a team that sort of represents your family history. So if you're Polish, are you German? Now, Italians are out of luck this time, as are the Irish, which takes out a huge portion of the American populace. If you have no family history with any of the teams in the World Cup, you can pick a country that you have a connection to. So, for example, I lived in France for a while, so I'm cheering for France. If none of this works for you, you get to pick a team for fun. I'd recommend Iceland, tiny Norse volcano gods who qualified for their first World Cup, even though the whole country only really started playing after 2000. Nigeria is another really fun team. They play a cool style of soccer. They definitely have the coolest jerseys out there. Of course, if you want to cheer for recognizable players, you can cheer for England, but only if you want to be crushingly disappointed once again. Go forth, pick your team, and happy World Cup.
I went online and did one of those, you know, how to pick a World Cup rooting interest tests.
Yes.
And it didn't help me at all because it all asks you opinions about what kind of soccer you like. Do you like defense or offense? I have zero opinions about soccer at all. So that didn't help me a bit. So I went to the great grandmother route. She was from England. But what really clinched it for me was a two-pronged thing to root for England. One, I read somewhere they have about a 4% chance of winning this thing, and that might even be high, and I like lost causes. But the final clincher was I'm a fan of the 1990s Britpop band Blur, and their bass player wrote a parody soccer chant song in the late 90s called Vindaloo. And it's ridiculous, and no one got the joke, and English soccer fans adopted it unironically and chant it and sing it at soccer games, and it's the most ridiculous song you've ever heard in your life, and I like to sing it, especially when I've had some beers, so that's what I'm going with. Go England.
Completely legitimate.
I'm going to offer another alternative. In the last World Cup, one of my daughters rooted for Costa Rica because Costa Rica, she said, is one of the few countries without an army, so... In case you need to find reasons to root for some team, be creative. I took that survey as well, Craig, and Spain popped up, which is absolutely right. So I am prepared to certify the survey as completely scientifically valid.
You know, we had some great people make suggestions to me on the air the other night. Like one guy is from Cairo, Illinois, so he's cheering for Egypt. Another guy is from Peru, Illinois, so he's pulling for Peru.
Perfect.
So there's really any number of ways that you can pick your team in this. Just it has to be fun.
All right. In a Washington Post op-ed this week, Deborah Epstein explains why she resigned from the NFL Players Association Commission on Domestic Violence. She's the co-director of the Domestic Violence Clinic at Georgetown University Law Center. And she had worried that Demora Smith, the NFLPA's executive director, was only paying lip service to the issue of domestic violence back when she was asked to be on this committee. And now she said, yeah, she was right. It was lip service. She says the commission has paid no attention to the recommendations she's made, that the group has met only 3 times over the course of 2 years. This is more than discouraging to me because it makes it sound as if the players' union, or at least its leader, has adopted the same strategy as the league itself with regard to violence against women. That is, don't worry about it unless there's video. Should we be surprised that the union, or at least its leadership, hasn't done better than the league has done alongside this issue, Craig?
Not surprised. We should be saddened, but we should not be surprised. I think that same story has played out in almost any other sort of disciplinary situation in professional sports where, one, if you don't have video or if you don't have something shocking that could lead local newscasts or national newscasts, people aren't going to be as animated about the issues as they should, and that's regrettable, but it's just how it works. More specifically, sports unions have been notoriously bad taking the lead on matters that would actually result in discipline to their own members. There's some understandable reasons for that, but with something as serious as domestic violence, given that there's been no leadership by the NFL either, you would hope someone would step in and take a moral and ethical stand on this.
Craig and I are both former attorneys. I spent a lot of time working with domestic violence victims as an attorney, so this doesn't surprise me, particularly coming from Demora Smith, who during the Ezekiel Elliott case was tweeting out stuff from the NFLPA Twitter account, basically taking his side and calling the woman a liar. Not only do we need to be educating the players, but we need to be educating the owners, the coaches, and apparently the union heads. It's been disappointing on both sides. You know, we had Lisa Friel come in for the NFL to head up that side of the domestic violence investigations. She has been someone very active in the DV community for a long time, and I've been crushingly disappointed in her work since she's been there. And, you know, if as long as there is really no desire to discipline these guys on the NFL side, on the employer side, why should the employees be out there wanting to discipline themselves? It just seems like it's never going to happen.
Maybe the only positive in this story is that Deborah Epstein has had the opportunity to express her discouragement with this pseudo effort and will move on to a more positive direction from that. Craig, close it out for us.
The Tampa Bay Rays, who most people shouldn't probably care about at all because, you know, they're the Tampa Bay Rays, have been doing something very, very odd this year. They don't have any good starting pitchers or not enough of them, so they have been using committees of relief pitchers to start games, complete entire games, and generally just make a mockery of the idea of the starting pitcher. They've lately even gone to something called an opener, where they begin with a reliever with the idea that he's only going to get a couple of innings and then they're going to move on to other relievers, and it hasn't worked very well, again, because they're the Tampa Bay Rays and their players aren't very good. The reaction is outrage, it's shock, and it's even proposals to change the rules of baseball to prevent a team from using their relief pitchers like this. What fascinates me about this is, on one hand, I get it. Baseball is traditional. Baseball marks the time, as that hacky horrible movie once said. Baseball has no idea, and the fans have no idea, and the media have no idea, I think, how to deal with change, and we just want some constancy, dang it.
I mean, if there is one sport that sort of embodies get off my lawn among the fans, it's baseball, right?
And they have a lawn.
Baseball is really falling behind, and they keep being concerned that they're losing the millennial generation and the digital generation after that. But there is absolutely no innovation in this game. We looked at the World Baseball Classic. We've got all these guys having fun. Homers, bat flips, all that kind of stuff. And then we've got immediately a bunch of old white guys, no offense, screaming their heads off about how this isn't how the game is played. Javi Baez plays here for the Chicago Cubs. He's one of the most exciting players to watch. And all we hear from other baseball fans is what a horrible person Javi Baez is because he's flashy and fun to watch. So it's a real problem baseball has, both on the field and in the fan base. And if they want to get to the next generation, some of this stuff's going to have to change.
I'm going to defend the Rays on this particular sort of innovation. If you're not going to be competitive, at least be entertaining, be innovative perhaps, and hey, be controversial. Give people something to talk about, even if it's something that they hate. Craig, wrap it up for us.
Well, first I'm going to note that Julie called us old men and said no offense.
I was going to pretend that hadn't happened.
I mean, it's true, but, you know, still, come on, man. Oh, anyway, that aside, you know, the best thing that spun out of this is in my writing about baseball, whenever the Rays play, rather than, you know, name five or six pitchers that go in a game, I just refer to the Rays staff as Johnny Holstaff. That's a guy. Every day, Johnny Holstaff is pitching for the Rays, and it just makes my recaps and write-ups much easier.
And Holstaff is pretty much the workhorse of the pitching staff.
Yeah, he's going to have a lot of appearances this year.
My guest for this week's edition of Three Stories You Should Know have been Julie DeCaro. She's a sports writer and an anchor for Chicago's 670 The Score, and Craig Calcaterra of NBC Sports. Thanks to both of you.
Thanks, Bill.
Thank you very much.
CyUNBN has long dreamed of making it to the NBA, but before he could be a pro basketball player, he had to take another job.
They were saying our team translator just left. Your English pretty okay. Do you want to be a translator?
That's just ahead on Only a Game, and remember to follow us on Facebook and Twitter at Only a Game NPR.
Ever get to Friday, look back on the week, and say to yourself, what just happened? I'm Sam Sanders. Check out my podcast, It's Been a Minute, where every Friday we catch up on the news and the culture of the week and try to make sense of it all. Listen on the NPR One app or wherever you get your podcast.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up next week on Only a Game, the daughter of the late George Carlin tells the story of how the Mets and the Dodgers almost killed her dad. But right now it's time for my conversation about this week's news with Charlie Pierce. Hello, Charlie.
Hey, Bill.
The Washington Capitals are your 2018 Stanley Cup champions. They defeated the Vegas Golden Knights 4-1. The Knights were almost the story of the year. Are you okay with the outcome?
Yeah, I think the Knights were the story of the year. But at the same time, you've got a Stanley Cup for Alex Ovechkin, who, regardless of his, you know, very bad taste in dictators he likes to hang around with, you can't see unbridled joy like that in a superstar athlete very often. I thought he was going to skate right out the door with the Stanley Cup and wind up at the Washington Monument.
As the NBA Finals wound down this week, ESPN's Stephen A. Smith reported that LeBron James will be talking with 7 teams when NBA free agency begins this summer. Can you find a good fit in there among the 7?
Well, I think the way LeBron plays the game, he's a good fit pretty much everywhere. The team that raised everybody's eyebrows was the Celtics. You know, you'd have to be Kreskin or Doug Henning or somebody to make the salary cap work on that. But it is an intriguing possibility.
You don't suppose the Cavs were distracted by those rumors of the 7 teams to which LeBron James might go?
Well, they've been living with that notion for all year.
The WNBA's leading scorer, Diana Taurasi, reached a milestone on Tuesday night, Charlie. She passed the 8,000-point mark during a game in which her Phoenix Mercury beat the New York Liberty. She's the league's all-time leading scorer, so good on her, say.
Yeah. I mean, the qualifier is, of course, that the WNBA hasn't been around long enough for anybody to score more than 8,000
points. And their season is short.
And they play a short season. Yeah, there's no question that she's the best scorer that ever played in that league.
She has also scored thousands and thousands of points playing in Russia over the winter, which is the real basketball season. Those should probably count, too, right?
Well, that's up there with Ichiro's Japanese stats, isn't it?
Absolutely. Former San Francisco 49er Dwight Clark became famous for catching the pass that enabled the 49ers to beat Dallas back in the NFC Championship game in 1981. He died on Monday of ALS. He was only 61 years old. He played for 9 years. His teams won 2 Super Bowls, and what people talk about is that catch.
One catch, that's right, the one that beat the Cowboys and sent the 49ers on their way to being a dynasty, and his family is going to donate his brain for medical research, which good on them, too. You know, it's a terrible story, but it's also a lovely story. Clark had moved to a ranch in Montana. They all showed up
his
one
teammates
weekend.
All showed up,
For one weekend. He may well be another victim of the game he loved. At the same time, it's quite an illustration of what teammates mean.
Max Scherzer, who pitches for the Washington Nationals through the second, quote, immaculate inning of his career. He did that on Tuesday night. Did you know what an immaculate inning was before that? Because I confess I did not.
I did not. Neither did I know that only 5 pitchers have 2 of them in their careers, and Scherzer's now one of them. Yeah, it's striking out all 3 batters on 9 pitches.
Right.
It's one of those oddball baseball things that the people who are real baseball fans love. I'm astonished by it myself.
And the old Bull Durham line is, strikeouts aren't democratic.
Yeah, that's right.
Involve
they're fascist.
Your teammates. That's they're right. Fascist, right?
Well, I mean, he can't help it if the other guys don't swing.
That's a good point. Excellent point. While she was watching a ball game between the Padres and the Braves on Tuesday night, Gabby DeMarco caught a baseball in her beer cup. This happens from time to time. Numbers of people have done it, yes.
Oh, okay.
But with what she did after she caught the ball, Ms. DeMarco made herself an internet sensation. What'd she do?
She fired down the rest of the beer, damn it.
With the ball, still in the cup.
Absolutely. She paid, you know, $40 for the beer, probably. The beer cost much more than the baseball did. Why wouldn't you finish it?
And finally, Charlie.
Okay, go ahead. Go ahead.
There aren't supposed to be any bears on Rishiri Island in Japan. But before a recent race there, somebody found bear footprints. So runners were given small bells to scare away the bear. Were bears. And the bells worked. One particular runner said she rang her bell throughout the race and she didn't see a single bear. So what more proof would anybody need?
Isn't this the living definition of the old joke about why do elephants wear red sneakers? To hide in a cherry tree? You ever seen an elephant in a cherry tree? No. See, it works.
See? It's obvious.
By the way, do bells scare away bears?
I mean, I was told they did. I thought you were supposed to sing or something. You can sing. You can sing, and my children sang very loudly when we went on a hike in Montana, and we rang bells as well.
And you didn't see any bears?
Not a single one, so it worked like a charm.
The bears were all sitting around in bear country going, these people are crazy.
Yeah, either that or we were ringing the bells and singing so loudly we didn't hear the bears harmonizing.
Exactly right.
You can find the sports writing of Charlie Pearson, Sports Illustrated, from time to time. And, of course, he joins me each week on Only a Game as well. Thank you, Charlie.
Thanks, Bill.
We didn't have to go far for our next story.
Right across the street, actually, at the BU gym.
That's Only a Game producer, Alex Schroeder. After work a few weeks back, Alex was playing basketball.
Yeah, so there's four courts, and the first one you kind of know are the ballers. Those are the guys who are there pretty much every single day.
Alex joined a game on the second court, and one player on his team stood out. He was dressed in Portland Trailblazers colors, red and black, and he spoke with an accent.
He was not like a big guy necessarily, but you could tell just by his shooting stroke, his handles, that he was a serious player.
So you guys won?
We won, yeah. Everybody kind of takes a break, grabs water, whatever, and then you come back on the court. You know, we're expecting to just get right back to it, and we kind of look around and notice we only had four guys.
Alex searched around and found his missing teammate in the middle of a game on the first court. Alex figured that was the end of the story, but it wasn't.
Later that night, as I was getting ready to leave, the guy in the black and red came over to introduce himself. His name was Sai Wenbian. Bien grew up in Beijing. He fell in love with basketball when he was 6.5 years old. That's when he first saw Space Jam.
And after I saw that movie, I think basketball is really fun. You know, like maybe I can fly if I play basketball and I can go to moon, you know, out of the earth.
A reasonable expectation for a 6.5-year-old. And to be fair, the game has taken Bien pretty far. As a kid, he played at nearby rec centers. By the time he got to high school, he couldn't be without the game for very long.
I played in the morning, and during the lunchtime, I just using the lunchtime to play basketball.
Bien played through high school and ended up on a junior pro team, but clubs in the Chinese Basketball Association, or CBA, weren't interested. As his 21st birthday approached and he was about to age out of juniors, Bien thought about giving up on basketball. Until he got a message from God.
His name is God Sham God.
God Sham God. A former second-round NBA draft pick was in China playing in the CBA and teaching clinics. Bien attended one.
And he woke up in the front of me and said, Bien, you are good. He got handles.
Shamgod picked Bien to be his partner for a demonstration. This was big, because Bien's coaches didn't usually give him this kind of encouragement.
After practice, I speak with him with my poor English. I said, you know, I want to play. And he said, you should continue to play. You are really good. Maybe you can go to U.S. to play ball and learn English. He gave me so much confidence.
The following year, An agency in China helped Bien get accepted to Menlo College in Silicon Valley, a small school that competes in the lower-level National Association of Intercollegiate Athletics.
So that kind of takes me to, well, first of all, who did you talk to in the U.S. before you came to the U.S.? Anybody?
Nobody, actually. Yes.
In January 2008, Bien hopped on a plane headed for San Francisco.
And I remember I arrived at 4 or 5 p.m., and it's kind of like a raining day, no sunshine, not warm. People speak English, which is I don't understand at all. I told myself I need to find a Chinese guy to looking for help. I saw one guy looks like a Chinese, and I go up to talk to him in Chinese. I need some help. Can you tell me how can I get to my school?
Turned out the guy was headed to Stanford, and Menlo College was on the way.
He said we can go together, and we both took the super shuttle.
The basketball season had already begun, and the coaches told Bien he would have to wait until next year to try out. In the meantime, Bien spent his first semester in language school, and, as should be a surprise to no one, practicing in the same gym where the team worked out.
So in their mind, they know there's a Chinese guy who wants to play on the team so bad.
His plan worked. Just before the school year started back up in the fall, the head coach handed Bien a jersey and a spot on the team. Bien says he almost cried. But his transition onto the team was frustrating. Bien says he was definitely a bench player.
Because during that time, my English is really poor. I don't even know the place very well. I don't know what are they saying. I don't understand except let's go.
Slowly, Bien got more playing time. He became closer with his teammates too. But the following year, he got injured and had to sit out, and that didn't put him any closer to becoming a pro. Instead of giving up, Bien came up with an even crazier plan. It hit him that March.
College basketball! CBS Sports! This is March Madness!
Bien was watching March Madness and saw the best Division I teams in the country competing. He wanted to be a part of that. It just so happened that one of Bien's teammates was from Lawrence, Kansas, home of the Jayhawks, who had won a national title in 2008. He told Bien to check them out. It might seem like an audacious plan. Things aren't working out on a lower-level college team, so aim higher. Bien told his teammates he was transferring.
And they were all saying, for what? And I said, for basketball. They just, you know, they think I'm like eating or have something wrong with my mind. And they just feel, you know, Bien, you need to go to a mental hospital.
Instead, he went to Lawrence, Kansas. Bien befriended eventual top 10 NBA draft pick Ben McLemore, rebounding for him for hours. His goal was to try out as a walk-on.
I went through the tryouts, but they didn't take anyone.
But before Bien could leave, the coaches stopped him and one other guy.
They said, you two guys can be, you know, practice players. And at that time, I was so surprised.
Whenever the coach called, Bien showed up at the Kansas gym. He and the other practice players usually came on when fresh legs were needed to play defense during drills. Bien served the role 2 years and then he graduated. NBA teams weren't exactly interested in a Kansas practice player, but Bien wasn't ready to give up on his dream of playing pro ball. So, it was back to China and another round of tryouts for teams in the CBA.
Every team I went there, I think I will make it, and I tried, but they all failed. And I was so depressed, and I went back to Beijing, and I don't want to see anyone, and I don't want to play basketball anymore.
It was the lowest Bien had been. After half a dozen tryouts, no one wanted to take him. But 2 days later, the last team he had tried out for gave him a call.
They were saying, our team translator just left. Your English pretty okay. Do you want to be a translator?
The team, Jiangsu Tongxi, told Bien if he took the job, he could use their facilities to keep working out. And maybe next season they would give him another chance. So Bien took the job and started working with the import players who needed to get around the city. It was a reliable gig that kept him close to the game he loves. How were you really feeling when you were a translator? Like, you weren't a player. Did you feel like part of the team still?
Yeah, I feel I'm a part of the team. But there's one feeling I feel so bad is I'm only 1 foot away from the dream because I couldn't step in the court. But I step off the court right there and right beside of the coach.
Bien had always impressed those around him with the amount of practicing he did on his own time. And just like every team before, Jiangsu Tongxi gave him a chance. They let him practice with the team in the summer, and then even sent him to the CBA Developmental League to get game experience. When it came time to re-sign his contract as a translator, Bien got an upgraded offer.
They said, "Are we going to offer you, you know, half and half, you know, translator and the player's contract?"
Bien was finally a professional basketball player.
I just feel really excited.
But when the season began, Bien never left the bench.
So I was kind of like, you know, this may be just a joke, you know, or I will probably never going to play.
Bien sat for the first 20 games of the season. But for the 21st game, the team was playing in Beijing, Bien's hometown. The coaches told him to be ready. Before the game, he was nervous. He tried to recite plays to himself to focus and calm down.
I was so afraid to play bad in the front of my parents, friends, and hometown. My heart beats too quick. I almost pee myself. Almost, to be seriously.
Bien was subbed in during the first quarter, and then it happened. He came up with a loose ball.
And I start dribbling from our free throw line, and I keep like pushing the ball, and I coast to coast, I make a Europe step, I made the layup. I was kind of screaming a little bit after I made it. But I didn't really mean to do that. I just feel I have so much pressure I need to release out.
The layup was Bien's only bucket of the game. And even though his team went on to lose by almost 30, it was the biggest shot of his life. The excitement didn't stop there, though. In his next game, Bien came off the bench to score 7 points in 11 minutes. He played in 3 more games that season, even getting to start. And although Bien hasn't fulfilled his dream of playing in the NBA yet, sneaker companies have paid him to translate for NBA players, and he's gotten close with some of them.
I've been translated for Derrick Rose, Damian Lillard, my favorite, Stephen Curry, like all those players become like into my life. And I just feel whenever I've been talking with those superstars, I feel they love the game from the deep, just like when I was 6 and a half. I can't really, you know, have a physical ability like them, but the way we love the game is same.
Bien's love for the game has kept him chasing that NBA dream. He's a 28-year-old free agent, and he wants to try out for the NBA's developmental G League. I ask him, though, if he'll keep translating.
Translating, coaching, is all my passion.
As long as it's in basketball.
Yes, as long as, yeah, related to basketball. I will be fine.
That story was produced and reported by Alex Schroeder. Only a Game is produced by Martin Kessler and Gary Wallach with help from Alex Schroeder and Matthew Stock. Our technical director is Marquise Neal, and our senior producer is Karen Gibbon. Our final word this week comes from Sayuan Bien, whose job working with NBA stars who visit his country must be fun, right?
To be a translator in China, actually it's kind of like a babysitter.
Oh, and the babies are big, really big. Sorry I asked. I'm Bill Littlefield. We return next week with more sports on Only a Game. Thanks for listening.